It is Monday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Islamic State claims responsibility for a suicide blast at a Shiite mosque in Afghanistan. U.S. President Barack Obama speaks about his support for the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
I believe that TPP is a plus for America's economy, America's workers, American jobs.
And a new film tells the story of a boxer who overcame injury to win a world title. It's all ahead. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for Monday's suicide bombing of a Shiite mosque in Kabul that killed at least 32 people and wounded more than 80. The bombing occurred at the crowded Bakir ul-Ulum Mosque in the Afghan capital during a religious ceremony. I spoke with the reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, who told me how events unfolded.
Well, what the officials who are involved in investigations currently have said is that a suicide bomber on foot actually stormed this crowded Shiite mosque where a ceremony was underway and detonated the explosives he had strapped to his body. And that was quite a massive explosion because it instantly killed at least 30 people and more than 80 people were taken to hospitals, and they included women and children. So it was quite a massive attack this morning in Kabul.
A brief statement issued by Islamic State's media wing said it was behind the bloodshed. Ayaz Ghul describes the initial speculation surrounding the bombing.
The Taliban insurgency, which is usually blamed for all such attacks across the country, instantly issued a statement saying it has nothing to do with the attack. But Afghan officials suspect that the Islamic State could be behind this bloodshed because lately there has been an increase in attacks against Shiite Muslims in Afghanistan, and most of the time this Middle Eastern terrorist group has claimed responsibility for such attacks. And I can tell you that on October the 11th, there was a Shiite ceremony underway in Kabul. And there was a massive attack, like there were two suicide bombers who stormed that mosque in another part of Kabul and killed 19 people, and IS quickly claimed responsibility for that. So the suspicions for this attack have also fallen on Islamic State.
Will Shiites have to take greater precautions? I mean, will security have to be tightened in some of these mosques?
Well, that's what, you know, the Shiite community, ever since they have come under attack since July, you know, when there was a massive bombing of a peaceful demonstration of the Shiite community in Kabul and more than 80 people were killed. Since then, there have been demands from this community that the government should increase security around their worship places. But as we know that Afghanistan, especially security forces in Afghanistan, have been struggling to tackle with the Taliban insurgency, and now that they have to deal with this new phenomenon, the Islamic State, which is carrying out these attacks, it's becoming a challenging task for the national security forces there. But the government, you know, President Ashraf Ghani has come out with a very strong statement. He condemned this attack and promised to do everything possible to bring the perpetrators to justice. But so far, we have not seen any significant progress in all these investigations that have been carried out into these attacks against Shiite community in Afghanistan.
That's Ayaz Ghul reporting on Monday's bombing in Kabul. The United States denounced the mosque bombing as a senseless and cowardly act and extended its condolences to the families of the victims. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what kind of reaction has there been to this bombing in Kabul?
Well, we are indeed seeing condolences, and we're also seeing, as Ayaz Ghul talked about, the speculation about who is responsible for this and what this means going forward. So that's kind of intermixed those two sentiments on social media, and we'll continue to monitor that as that develops. Here in the U.S., what's been trending throughout the entire weekend is Mike Mike Pence, the vice president-elect, and the musical Hamilton. The backstory here is that Mike Pence went to see the hit Broadway musical, and at the end of the show, Brandon Victor Dixon, who's the star of the show, had a message for Mike Pence talking about inclusiveness and asking and hoping that the administration includes people like women, minorities, gays and lesbians, other groups. Two things that are interesting about this. First, that when Brandon Victor Dixon started talking, he said, I want everybody to take out their cell phones and I want you to take video of this and post this. We want to get this message as far as possible. So using the power of social media there. And the second thing is Donald Trump's reaction. He went on Twitter and said that this was politically motivated, that they were attacking Mike Pence. And this has kind of kicked off a controversy on social media. However, as many people are pointing out, on Friday there was a ruling regarding a Trump University case, and Donald Trump settled for about $25 million, allegations of fraud against Trump University. A lot of speculation that this attack against the musical Hamilton by Trump was timed to deflect attention away from that Trump University settlement. In fact, I did see one trend graph of Google searches that show Hamilton and Trump searches overtaking Trump University searches. So there may be some support to that idea that they're deflecting. We'll continue to see if Donald Trump continues to tweet about the musical Hamilton or if it goes by the wayside. And then very quickly, and the story we've been talking with Ira Melman, our colleague, about all last week, fake news on Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, finally admits that, yes, the social network does have a problem with fake news, and they are going to take steps to combat that, allowing people to flag stories that might be fake or to report stories that aren't verified. So there are steps being taken to combat some of that.
Well, that's very encouraging. Thank you, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Syrian forces continue to strike rebel-held Aleppo. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the alliance's actions over the years have been defensive and proportionate. 142 people are killed in a train derailment in India, and Venezuela's president expresses an intent to improve relations with the United States. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists have discovered one of those rare and mysterious astrophysical events called fast radio burst, or FRB. A fast radio burst is just that, an incredibly fast but brilliant and powerful pulse of radio waves. So far, scientists are stumped as to exactly what causes this phenomenon. Since they're so fast and so unpredictable, only 18 have been spotted since their 2007 discovery. Researchers who discovered the newest FRB say it's the most brilliant and brief fast radio burst that has been found so far, and that it could provide insight into the cosmic web, a network of intergalactic material. The newly discovered FRB originated on August 7, 2015, and traveled a distance of more than a billion light years before being received at a radio telescope facility in Australia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about new controversy surrounding the International Criminal Court. Speaking Sunday at his final Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, or APEC, summit in Lima, Peru, President Barack Obama said APEC's 21 members remain committed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, free trade agreement reached earlier this year. But this is opposed by President-elect Donald Trump.
Our partners made very clear during the meeting that they want to move forward with TPP. Preferably, they'd like to move forward with the United States. A number of countries are already starting to ratify TPP. At the same time, we're already hearing calls for a less ambitious trade agreement in the region with lower standards, lower protections for workers, lower protections for the environment. That kind of agreement would obviously exclude U.S. workers and businesses and access to those markets. So for all those reasons, I believe that TPP is a plus for America's economy, America's workers, American jobs. I think not moving forward would undermine our position across the region and our ability to shape the rules of global trade in a way that reflects our interests and our values.
In a statement, the APEC members, while acknowledging rising skepticism over trade, committed themselves to fight protectionism and keep their markets open, with or without the United States. Mr. Trump also campaigned on renegotiating a fairer North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, with Canada and Mexico. Economist Gary Huffbauer of the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's possible the 11 other members of TPP could ratify the comprehensive agreement, even if the U.S. does not.
And the U.S. is the, you know, is obviously the biggest part of the party for most of the other members, but they're still a party even without the United States. And if they believe, as many of them do, that free trade or freer trade is in their own interests, they could conceivably go ahead and do this. I've heard this theme from Mexico. I was just down in Mexico last week, and I've heard it from New Zealand and even some soundings from Canada, Japan. The only country I've heard of that has shelved the prospect of ratifying TPP apart from the United States is Vietnam.
Donald Trump, the president-elect, says he's not opposed to trade agreements or even free trade agreements, but he is opposed to leaving people behind and losing jobs and being on the wrong end of the stick.
He goes on to say that he's willing to have trade agreements with individual countries. Senator Hatch, chairman of the Finance Committee, Senate Finance Committee, has proposed to the Trump incoming administration and to Trump himself that they should consider a free trade deal with Japan. Well, Trump just met with Prime Minister Abe. You know, it's conceivable that Trump could do some deals with individual countries, though I don't think that's a priority from his standpoint.
Well, he's indicated that he is going to renegotiate the NAFTA agreement, and if the terms are not agreeable to his administration, he'll walk away from it. Is that a disaster?
He has said he'll renegotiate. I believe he will renegotiate. The other countries will come in. We'll have talks, I think, which will extend for at least 6 months or more. If the United States were to completely denounce the NAFTA, in other words, completely walk away and put on a whole raft of new tariffs focused on Mexico, that would be a disaster. That's not the outcome I see. I see that as a threat. I listened to the campaign just like you did and everybody else did, but we have to take some of those campaign statements with a little bit of salt, and I don't think he's going to walk away from the whole agreement. What I think is more likely is that there will be additional protocols which may modify some of the terms of the NAFTA, may add new features, as opposed to a complete walk away story.
Meanwhile, China, not a party to TPP, has been pushing its own free trade regime called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, with a member of China's delegation to the APEC meeting indicating growing interest in joining the 16-nation bloc, including Peru and Chile. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has been rocked by a series of withdrawals by African countries that were original signatories to the Rome Statute that established the court. Last week, Russia also pulled its signature from the ICC treaty, and the Philippines could follow. Henry Ridgewell reports that the court could be facing a domino effect of countries quitting its jurisdiction.
Three African states, Burundi, South Africa, and Gambia, signaled their intention to quit the International Criminal Court this year, claiming the court disproportionately targets African leaders. Phil Clark is from the London University School of Oriental and African Studies.
There's a real concern right across Africa about the meddling of international actors in African affairs.
Russian President Vladimir Putin removed his country's signature from the founding treaty this week, though it had never ratified its membership. His Philippine counterpart said Thursday he might follow Moscow's lead, claiming that, in his words, only the small ones like us are battered. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda this week defended the court's actions.
As an international community, we should be more concerned about ensuring accountability and justice for these very serious atrocity crimes.
While some African countries plan to quit, others have engaged more directly with the ICC, says analyst Phil Clark.
Countries like Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo have in fact seen the ICC as a tool that they can use against their military and political opponents. Nigeria is also engaging in discussions with the ICC prosecutor at the moment about potentially opening investigations into crimes committed by Boko Haram.
The ICC is opening its first major investigations outside Africa, looking into potential war crimes in the 2008 Russia-Georgia conflict. It has also begun looking into torture allegations against US and British forces in Afghanistan.
Those, I think, are very important cases because it would enable the court to say, look, we're not just picking on African states, we're also willing to tackle the biggest powers in the world.
But as the United States is not a signatory to the court, any successful prosecution appears unlikely. And analysts say the series of member state withdrawals raises the prospect the ICC will no longer be seen as an institution of global justice. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A new film starring Miles Teller and Aaron Eckhart, Bleed for This, tells the inspiring true story of boxer Vinnie Pazienza, who overcame a broken neck to win a world title. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film.
Miles Teller and Vinnie Pazienza share a brotherhood neither one wanted. They were both in near-fatal car accidents. In Teller's case, he was in a crash 1 year before a good friend was killed in a car wreck. For Pazienza, a 1991 crash broke his neck and nearly ended his boxing career. Remarkably, the fighter came back from the injury, including training in a metal rig called a halo that was drilled into his skull, and was able to box again, winning the super middleweight title. Bleed for This tells the story of that comeback. Teller, best known for Whiplash and the Divergent movie series, trained with boxing trainer Daryl Foster, who trained fighters like Sugar Ray Leonard and helped Will Smith become Muhammad Ali for 2001's Ali. Teller says he thinks the film does Pazienza justice.
It was about an 8-month kind of physical test for me. I lost 20 pounds, got down to like 6% body fat, and you know, to me that was just to have the look of the guy, and then you gotta learn how to box, and I thought we made like a really beautiful film, and we did it in 24 days, really tight shoot, but it was just such a, I don't know, it just felt so authentic, and I know Vinny had just a beautiful response to the film, and that means everything.
Aaron Eckhart plays Pazienza's trainer, Kevin Rooney. He says Bleed for This shows the special trust that boxers have with the people in their corners.
It's a sacred bond, total trust. It's family. It's interesting when you see boxers, young boxers especially, come into the game. They always have their father. They always have their family and brothers and everything. And so that continues all the way through the fight game.
Miles Teller says that Pazienza was a larger-than-life character, and his comeback is the stuff of legend.
Vinny was known as much for his personality as he was for, you know, his wins and losses. Although he did have 50 wins and 5 world championships and fought, you know, a ton of guys. He was a showman. He loved Muhammad Ali. That's why he, you know, kind of wanted to get into boxing and knew how to sell a fight. And he just had a certain like you said, a charisma. He was an entertaining guy, and you just, you know, you do your homework and you try and play him as truthfully as possible.
Director Ben Younger says the film and Pazienza's comeback from injury inspired him and has inspired audiences.
I think that boxing is sort of this outsized but accessible parable for the challenges that any of us face. This one takes it to the next level because of Vinny's comeback and the injury, but the feeling people seem to get when they leave the theater, and it's what he did for me, honestly, on a personal level, which was you sort of reevaluate the issues you have in your life, the conflicts, the challenges that seem insurmountable. You see what this guy did, and everything just seems like doable.
Vinny Pazienza finished his career with 50 wins and 10 losses. He scored 18 of those wins and had 5 losses after his comeback from a broken neck. Bleed for This is distributed by Open Road Films and is rated R for language, sexuality, and car accident images. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That is Bleed for This. Sounds like quite an interesting film. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In recent remarks to foreign journalists, Secretary of State John Kerry emphasized the importance of U.S. engagement in some of the most difficult challenges our world faces. On security, the United States led the effort to form a coalition of over 60 nations that is helping to stop ISIL after it swept across Iraq and Syria, taking over cities, destroying communities, and murdering civilians. After 35 years of diplomatic silence, the United States not only helped start negotiations with Iran, but led the effort that ensured that Iran's nuclear program is and will remain exclusively peaceful. We continue to lead the fight against HIV/AIDS. As a result, said Secretary Kerry, today we're on the brink of seeing the first generation of AIDS-free children being born in Africa. And that's through PEPFAR, the United States program to help provide health care and change lives for people. When the recent Ebola epidemic first arose in West Africa, many predicted that it would claim as many as 1 million lives before it ran its course. But 3,000 U.S. troops sent to West Africa by President Barack Obama worked with personnel from many other nations to build up local health care capacity. We summoned an international movement, and guess what? Those 1 million people didn't die, said Secretary Kerry. On climate change, the United States made a pact with China that set an example of how to reduce emissions on a global basis, a move that helped set the stage for the signing of the Paris Agreement. We help craft the Kigali Agreement that will end the production and use of hydrofluorocarbons, and we help to set aside millions of square kilometers of ocean in the Antarctic, the Pacific, and the Atlantic to save our waters and fisheries. I have never seen the United States of America more engaged to the benefit of everybody else. In order to try to help other countries work their way through crises, to make peace and stability so we can go home and pay attention to things here, said Secretary of State Kerry. I've never seen us more engaged in more countries at one time on more issues of significance with greater consequence than now.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.